It's a beautiful morning, here and now, let's do the early Young Rascals song. I heard that on the airplane coming over here. Whenever I fly, I have profound insights on the plane. I don't know what it is. Maybe it has to do with all the tension everybody has in the airport before you get on the plane, and you know, packing and preparations and everything, and then all of a sudden you're on this plane 11-12 hours, and you're able to settle in. I like to listen sometimes to the music, you know, and almost inevitably one of the songs, boom, blubber and tears coming all down my face. Wonder what the neighbor thinks of me, but anyway, these things happen. Young Rascals, wasn't it? Of course, even going through those tense moments can... it's any time, anywhere. Over 10 years ago, this was before 9/11, and the real tenseness increased manyfold. I went to the Netherlands, and an old friend of mine who since has passed away, Kitahara Ryutaro, he was a, well, his father was one of the greatest poets and songwriters and children. Ame, ame, hudu, hudu, kaza, ame, that's his father. Kitahara Hakushu, yeah. But his son, Kitahara Ryutaro, was a lay disciple after being a soldier in the war and going through hell. He became a disciple of the Zen layman Hisamatsu Shinichi and also of Osaka Koryu. Probably you know Osaka Koryu, yeah. So he was a lay Zen man in his own right. And we went to the Netherlands, this was over 10 years ago, to do a retreat conference there. And he'd been in to Europe, so I don't know what the big deal was. He was getting old. But anyway, waiting in the line to go through the inspection there to go into Europe after arriving, he saw this long line of inspectors. And everyone was being asked, where do you come from? Where do you come from? And he thought this was so marvelous. And so when he got up to be asked, where do you come from? He did the best he could to restrain his laughter, but he also wanted to ask, of course, the inspector, where you come from? Fortunately, they didn't take him into one of those rooms where they do a body check or anything, but he did finally get through. But it certainly is any time, anywhere, but sometimes it's best to be circumspect. I read last night the short quote from the Ming Dynasty, the Chinese Zen master, Po Shan. That's actually not in his work, admonitions for those unable to arouse the doubt. It's kind of a prefatory remark that he makes before it. But it is central, and in a way it summarizes the whole issue. So I will read that quote one more time. It's clear, I think, the focus of the text in as a whole is doubt. The Japanese expression is gijo. Literally, it's something like gi-jo, a doubt sensation, or a sensation of doubt. But it's probably more naturally translated simply as doubt. Ai-jo, for example, is love. We don't say love sensation or love feeling. We just say love. As I mentioned last night, Po Shan describes here quite succinctly, briefly, the fundamental religious doubt that he's talking about, how it differs from ordinary doubt and skepticism, and also how it's connected with the doubt block or mass of doubt, gidan, literally, huh? the doubt block or mass of doubt, and the great doubt, literally Dai Gi, great doubt. Quoting once again Po Shan. In Zen practice, the essential point is to arouse doubt. What is this doubt? For example, when we were born, where did we come from? We cannot help but doubt, for we do not know. When we die, where will we go? Again, we cannot help but doubt. As long as you fail to break through this barrier of life and death, such doubt won't leave you. Try to get rid of it, you cannot. Try to get away from it, you cannot. Suddenly, you'll break through this doubt block and realize what a worthless contrivance is life and death. Ha! Just as they said of old, great doubt, great awakening. Small doubt, small awakening. No doubt, no awakening. End quote. You will see as the week goes on that in a nutshell, it's all just very briefly succinctly stated right there. It's almost a kind of a blueprint for what happens in Zen practice. The one thing he's certainly done is buried Pop Zen. 99% of the books on your bookshelf with the name Zen probably can now be dispensed with. Here and now, in your practice, is your zazen firmly established? Or is it still something you go into and come out of? Be patient, but not lax, not lazy. One-on-one can be very helpful to see that the focus is in the proper direction. Bankei's example is a fine one. I briefly mentioned his childhood struggle to come to know for himself what is this, where is this innate virtue. When he finally realized that the way he put it was, all, everything is perfectly or completely resolved in the unborn Buddha mind. That unborn simply means the mind prior to arising, this and that, before and after. Buddha, ordinary beings, and so on. That, more properly, this mind. He didn't simply have that idea. Thoroughly realizing that everything is resolved in this unborn Buddha mind. He then lived out his life from that. Po Shan himself went through his own struggle, which he describes. And as we will see for the rest of this week, he criticizes, as the title is, admonishments, rather strong warnings. We may wonder who was the audience he was saying these things to. But of course, the real point is, does he have something to say to us here and now? Needless to say, I think he has much to say. That's why I bothered to translate this short piece. Of course, we finally must respond in our own way to our own situation. We must do that. We're not here to imitate Poshan or Bankei or even Gautama Buddha. That is the importance of our own genuine, inevitable doubt, our own great doubt. One way of putting it is, it's hard to translate, at the bottom, underneath, simple character, shita, motto, shita. Underneath, at the bottom of the great doubt, lies great awakening. Otherwise, you know what happens, don't you? Indecisive, inconclusive, got a taste here, got a feeling here, but oh, now, wait a minute, I'm not sure about this. And we live out our lives. Maybe satisfied a little bit about some things, but deeply dissatisfied about other things. The way of Buddha is the way of awakening. Awakening is not inconclusive or indecisive. Awakening is awakening. In a sense, in a radical sense, there is no little bit. Even though Poshan said, small doubt, small awakening, in a way he was making fun of it. You may say a small insight. Small doubt, well, you'll have a small insight maybe. But that becomes itself an endless chasing after your own tail, trying to have that insight again, or a bigger one, or a better one. It becomes part of the dis-ease. The great doubt, one of the reasons it's great, is because it comes naturally through our own doubt to encompass, to include all. Naturally then, as Bankei made it so clear, all is, when you realize it, perfectly realized in this unborn. There's no need to create some kind of an artificial doubt, but do not deny or suppress the doubt, the genuine doubt that you do have. Embrace it. Dive into it. We have a marvelous group here working seamlessly and silently together, supporting and being supported by each other. A wonderful environment and a very mature group. This is, in a sense, great trust, great faith at work, in action, isn't it? Not only all of us, but countless others over endless time have given their all, as they say, ground their bones to dust so that you could have this opportunity. People that you don't even know about, that have done so much in so many ways so that you could have this opportunity. Please make good use of it. Let me read now the first section. There are 10 sections of this work on admonishments for those unable to arouse the doubt. There are 10 sections each, about less than one page. There was no title in the original for the 10 sections, but I gave titles, taking into account the content. The first section I have titled Diseases, Intellectual and Anti-Intellectual. One of the expressions that he uses is in Japanese Zen Byo, literally a Zen sickness. It's used in many different ways. Here, when he's talking about it, he's using it in a very general, generic sense, simply to mean anything that can get in the way, become an entanglement or a problem on the way in Zen practice, including deep insights and experiences, things that from this side can seem very good and very valuable and indeed have their worth. But anything that stops short of awakening and can even entangle us in that, he admonishes us, warns us about. So this first section is diseases, in other words, things to watch out for, intellectual and anti-intellectual, to quote from Poshan. If you are unable to arouse the doubt when practicing Zen, you may end up seeking intellectual understanding through the written word, swiftly stringing together phrases and teachings of Buddhas and patriarchs, you offer your stamp of approval. If a koan is brought up, you are quick to give your interpretation. Unable to arouse your own doubt concerning the koan, you don't like it when someone in the know probes you with serious questions. All this is simply your wavering mind. It is not Zen. You may respond at once to questions by raising a finger or showing a fist. Taking up ink brush, you promptly pen tasteful poems to show off, hoping to guide unwitting students to your level. Convinced you've attained a great enlightenment, you don't realize that such karmic consciousness is precisely what prevents you from arousing this doubt. If only you would straight off see the error of your ways, then you should once and for all let go of karmic consciousness and seek out a good teacher or Dharma friend to help you find an entrance. If not, your wavering mind will prevail. You'll become as if demon-possessed, and salvation or release will become very difficult. As I said, these are admonishments, strong warnings for us to heed. To read through it once more, commenting where necessary. If you're unable to arouse the doubt when practicing Zen, you may end up seeking intellectual understanding through the written word. No difficulty here, it's natural enough, huh? You can't penetrate it, so you go to the words. Huh? Swiftly stringing together phrases and teachings of Buddhas and patriarchs, you offer your stamp of approval. From your viewpoint, you gain some understanding of what is written. If a koan is brought up, you are quick to give your interpretation. Now he's nudging you. Huh? Unable to arouse your own doubt concerning the koan, you don't like it when someone in the know probes you with serious questions. And he sums up what he said so far. All this is simply your wavering mind, literally the mind of arising and ceasing, the samsaric, diseased mind. It is not Zen. That's the end of the first section, what I have described, the disease of the intellect, seeking to find peace through understanding the words alone. It's a pretty obvious danger, one often mentioned in Zen writings. The second paragraph is, in a sense, the other extreme. Realizing that that doesn't work, maybe being criticized for just having an intellectual understanding, right? Some people then just turn to, you might say, acting Zenistic. Acting out. Well then, okay, I'm not going to think or try to understand it. I'm just going to act like those people. Then I'll be Zen, right? Or this is no better, of course. But. So that's what he's pointing to in the second paragraph, to quote, "You may respond at once to questions by raising a finger or showing a fist." Well, of course, these are patent Zenistic acts. You may know from the Mumon Kan, for example, the gateless barrier, the famous story of the Zen master Gute, who his whole life just raised one finger to express his teaching. Or, you know, showing a fist, a little more kind of a dynamic Zenistic action. Huh? "Taking up ink brush, you promptly pen tasteful poems to show off, hoping to guide unwitting students to your level. Convinced you've attained a great enlightenment, you don't realize that such karmic consciousness," consciousness still involved in arising and ceasing, huh? "is precisely what prevents you from arousing this doubt. If only you would straight off see the error of your ways, then you should once and for all let go of karmic consciousness." This is something that is not so difficult to do in sustained Zazen, huh? At least for a time being. So once again, let go of karmic consciousness and seek out a good teacher or Dharma friend to help you find an entrance. "If not," he warns, summing up, "your wavering mind will prevail. You'll become as if demon-possessed, and salvation will become very difficult." It's a rather powerful admonishment, and once again, in a sense, we can't help but wonder, Who were the monks around him? What was the situation that caused him to write this piece? This is just the first section too, you know, there's 10 of them. But once again, the real point for us here and now at this retreat is, does he have something to say to us? If so, please take it to heart. I think it's clear from this first section that what we do is let go of everything, all the knowledge and the intellectual learning, the book reading that you've accumulated over the years, especially all the pop Zen stuff, the intellectual understandings, and admit, "I don't know." To put it in the Philadelphia idiom, "I don't know shit." This is a good place to start. From there, we can begin to truly inquire in all sincerity. One iota, one atom, one drop from your own experience is better than a truckload of someone else's garbage. I mentioned twice last night that poem where the monk lifts up his head to see that the sun has always been round. It's a rather nice and not very well-known poem, so I would like to give you most of it, because it points to many of the dangers and difficulties in this first section. His name was Lohan, or Dakan in Japanese. He says in his poem, in the Xiantung era, in other words, in the early 9th century, that's when he went on his pilgrimage, in the early 9th century, I began to study the way. Wherever I went, I met with words, but couldn't understand them. The doubt block within my heart was as big as a big wicker basket. For three springs, I found no joy in the quiet of wood and stream. He then goes on and talks about the Dharma encounter that he had, but that's something each one of us must go through, so I will leave out the details. The point is, continuing the poem, my doubt block shattered and fell with a crash. Raising my head to look about, I saw that the sun has always been round. After that, I went wandering, clump, clump, clack, clack, the sound of wandering. And from that day to this, have always been joyous. Belly full, I no longer go in search with bowl in hand. A nice tone and a feeling to it, a very personal sentiment of an individual who has gone through this. Huh? But once again, it's all there. For present purposes, it's especially suggestive, the third and the fourth lines, where he says, wherever I went, I met with words, huh? Either studying or reading or maybe hearing what was being spoken about. This Zen master said that, that Zen master responded that. But he continues, but I couldn't understand them. This is much better than thinking you do understand them. He didn't understand them, but he pursued. He continued on, as he describes it, the doubt block within my heart, as big as a big wicker basket. And once again, when, as we all do, he came to it, he describes it very matter-of-factly, very prosaically. What did he realize? Sun has always been round. How different is this from Bankei realizing that all things are perfectly resolved in the unborn? You don't realize anything new, in a sense. Everything's still here, and yet different from the ground up. For the first time, he recognized that the sun had always been round. Well, every child knows that, doesn't he? Well, they do and they don't. Not one thing in the world changes. The tree still goes up. The sky sometimes rains. Sometimes it snows. In that sense, not one thing is different. And yet everything has changed from the ground up. To put it bluntly, the only change is that the separation is gone. We have, so to speak, separated from the separation. That's the only thing that goes, the separation that self is. And he describes it wonderfully. I saw. For the first time, I really saw that the sun has always been round. And then he just went wandering, belly full, huh? For the Chinese, needless to say, this means profoundly content. I no longer go in search with bowl in hand, huh? Going around begging. Well, he probably did continue to do that, but not quite the same way as before. For us also, during this retreat, we eat. We don't have to go begging, fortunately. We have nutritious meals prepared for us. Enjoy the meals. Have a nutritious meal so that you can continue your practice. Give yourself completely to your practice. But be careful not to overindulge in the meal, the food. It's rather subtle, but when you're still really struggling and bumping up against yourself, the practice can be very, very tiring, very, very difficult, very, very frustrating. So when you have a chance to take a break, sleep for a while, or indulge in food, this kind of a pleasure, sometimes you can lose yourself in a bad way that way. So do be mindful, not just on the cushion, but in having a meal. That is itself a precious part of the practice. Receiving this precious food and taking enough so that we can give ourselves fully and complete the practice. The same with resting. When we have breaks, if you wish to rest, please rest so that you will be fresh for the sitting. You might want to take a walk and stretch your legs during the break. Do some stretches if you do yoga or something like that. Without overindulging, without self-indulgence, we take care so that we can maintain the practice throughout the week. The same thing with being quiet and still. There's no one here to yell at you, as they may in the monastery, if you are not perfectly quiet or perfectly still. And yet there is a virtue to being quiet, to being still. And the best way to know that is to be quiet and be still. And then you realize it's not Zen, but it is a very helpful way to enter and sustain the samadhi, the concentrated oneness. Quietness and remaining still, even though there may be some pain, for example, but remaining in the posture for the period. It's not torture, but it's a helpful way of sustaining the practice. I've been speaking for a good half an hour, so please feel free to stand up and stretch now if you'd like.